Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're still kind of going through, I want to say it's the Sixth Amendment, and it is. And we have Paul here. And, you know, Paul, yesterday was kind of a day of interruptions. I apologize with my wife calling. She was needing some help, and I typically don't have the phone in the studio, so she really lucked out.
Interesting. Shortly after your wife called you, my wife called me. So I was able to take care of that after the show.
Yeah, it's not easy, you know, actually kind of providing, I'll just say, a decent professionally produced show while you've got, you know, somebody distracting you or what have you. Oh, by the way, I might as well let you know, I am in the final throes of doing a presentation or doing the layout for a presentation on the Convention of States and the nullification argument. You know, in other words, how the conventionites and the anti-conventionites have created a binary conversation when both of them are in the wrong position.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So once I have this done, I will send it to you because I think you might enjoy, you know, what, you know, the material and kind of the work that I put into this, because one of the things I've realized is this color-coded constitution really helps. I mean, mm-hmm. really helps. So that you can actually visualize, because in this presentation, I actually created these small little images of the Constitution so people could actually see all of the color, you know. And right. Hey, by the way, here's the Constitution all the way up through the Bill of Rights, and voila. You know, look at all of the violations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then they go, wow, that there's not a lot of white there. Right.
No. Hardly any.
Anyway, right. So, okay. We were just talking about the Sixth Amendment, and the real question goes out to, when we look at an international crime and how a state claims that a crime was committed, and it goes into, well, what law, what specific law was broken? And the question, you know, because I understand each state has and runs their own election. But when it comes to a federal election, what expectation or what jurisdiction does the federal government have? And so, when it comes to a federal election for Congress and the Senate, they only have the jurisdiction over the place, time, and manner, right? I mean, that's what we've already covered. But the presidential election, there is federal jurisdiction over the Electoral College and the process of the Electoral College.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. I mean, there's actually a lot of language there that talks about the choosing of the president and the process. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that Trump wasn't lecturing him on the purity of the Electoral College. There's no doubt in my mind that he was probably, you know, going, hey, go out and see if you can harvest some more votes or whatever. Because I'm really not following the case. But I do know that the fact that they're basically going after him, and this is just odd that they're doing this. There had to have been. Kemp is a Republican. You'd think that Kemp, as a Republican governor, would have not been a drama queen regarding Trump calling him and saying, "What can you do?" Or, you know, because Georgia, we did not anticipate losing Georgia. How did that happen on your watch?
Sure.
And so, that, I mean, right? I mean, I think Trump has every right to call the executive of the state and the executive of the party, even though the state party chair may be somebody else. But technically, the top dog, the top Republican, just like the top Republican in the nation, was Trump at the time. The top mm-hmm. Republican in that state was Governor Kemp. And right. so I could honestly see that there would have been some, possibly some really harsh words, and maybe Kemp got his feelings hurt, you know, and so how is that a crime?
Okay.
What could he have said that would have made it a crime?
Right. What is the crime?
That's right. So I'm just question. Trying to imagine what would literally be an actual crime. Did Trump call to tell him to violate the law, to outright violate the law? Hmm. So here's the question. If I call you and say, Paul, I want you to get over here and I want you to, I don't care how fast you have to travel, you get here by this point in time. Now, okay. What I just basically said is, I want you to break the law. Is that a crime?
Even saying I want you to break the law isn't necessarily a crime. You
right.
just said something stupid.
Okay. Right? So maybe I conveyed a threat to you. Would that be a crime? Well, it all depends on the feasibility and the reality of the threat, right? I mean, you know, like you're going to regret this. That's a threat, right?
It could be.
Well, I mean, I'm going to do something to you that you have no idea, and you're going to regret the fact that you crossed me or something like that. That would be considered a threat, right?
Now, it would be considered a threat, okay? Now, if someone were to say, it would be different if you say, hey, if you do this thing, mm-hmm. this consequence will happen by a cause of nature. That's not necessarily a threat. That's just saying, this is not a good idea. You might break something. But yes, if you're saying, you're going to regret this, you could regret this if you don't do this my way or do this particular thing. Yeah, that could be taken as a threat. Right?
Yeah, but so when does a threat, because, there are times when somebody just says something in, at the spur of the moment, heat of the moment type of thing to where, and as a matter of fact, doesn't Trump, I've got Trump and Kemp mashed together here. Doesn't Trump actually have a record for, a lack of control of what he says?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So because he's loose with the lips and he says something, does that mean that he's actually going to act upon it? Or is it just one of those things that, is just a slip, or I wouldn't even call it a slip. It's just hyperbole.
He does that frequently and he's known for it.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, everything is great. He uses the word great all the time, or, it rigged, or hyperbole. This guy lives in his vernacular at a hyperbolic level. Does that not make sense?
Sure.
And so I can't understand how, somebody that actually has that, I just don't see. Other than the fact that the court itself is rigged, which we see our courts are rigged, but I just don't understand how this is justice in America. And as a matter of fact, I honestly think that if there's multiple cases, which I believe there are, again, folks, I apologize for not following this, but this goes into the constitutionality. This is why we're talking about this. I honestly see that his legal team should have said, okay, obviously there's still some grand juries out there, and we demand that they all basically come forward with all of their, you know, their claims of trial, and then we're going to seek to adjoin all of these.
You know, GR, I've asked a couple of attorneys about what they get in terms of training the Constitution, and most of them, in their entire educational experience, probably get a class on the Constitution. So, you know, you and I have taken kind of the deep dive, and you say things that would seem obvious now, because we've delved into these, you know, reading it causes you to ask questions as to why something isn't being done. So you ask these questions, and GR, you suggest that maybe his legal team would do something like this. Well, they're not reading the Constitution. It doesn't take that deep a read to see something and say and ask questions. It's challenging, GR. I think constitutional ignorance is so prevalent. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. And that people who would benefit from just a cursory reading don't really realize what's going on.
Right, right. So let's get into this last part, okay? Because you kind of covered to the cause of the accusation. This is the next.
Right,
okay. This is the next part. To be confronted with the witnesses against him. In
right.
other words, you have a right to confront them and to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor. So in other words, let's look at it this way. He went through an election that was, you know, literally being co-opted by social media in 2016, mm-hmm. an election that was being co-opted by social media. It was actually being, you know, I'll just say undermined by the Department of Justice, because mm-hmm. the Department of Justice was actually, you know, playing favoritism for Hillary and, you know, turning their head, and they did the exact same thing. So here's my point. He now has the ability to bring forth all of these people to say, look, I was running. This is where he could expose everything in this whole election case, because all he needs is to bring forward witnesses in his behalf, even though they may be hostile.
Yes, it says to have
compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor.
Right.
And so... So literally, he could actually try the whole 2020 election and the shenanigans that he literally saw unfold in front of him right there mm-hmm. in these courts. And bottom line, the fact of adjoining these would literally, you know, force this to happen, because the more, I mean, and as a matter of fact, it would be smart for the prosecution to actually go for the adjoinment, because you realize that as the roadshow begins in one court, you don't want that the same stuff to be done again and again and again, to where he actually does a better job and a better job at presenting how the system was rigged against him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You see my point?
Wow. Yes, absolutely.
And so, because... he has a right to defend himself. You know, he doesn't have he's not obligated to sit there and be beaten. This is a court of justice, not a court of, you know, of an outcome. And that's how our courts have been perverted. They are courts of outcome.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like justice has been completely lost.
What you're saying, GR, is that he's got the means and the ability to use the Constitution to force the courts to behave. Right?
He has the means and ability to actually exploit the system. in his behalf. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
But constitutionally.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hot dog.
But the problem is that his legal team is failing him because, as you stated, there's nobody in the legal system, not even his lawyers, not even in politics, that actually understand the Constitution. They just have learned how they've been able to pervert and have advantages and have controls to protect themselves, all unconstitutionally. See, the court has literally been undermining our liberties. They've been giving the government the advantages, as we've already covered with the open fields doctrine.
Correct.
And many other things. As we talk about, you know, Baker v. Carr, Reynolds v. Sims. I mean, there's just a plethora of cases where they have redefined the Constitution. And they don't have, there's nowhere in this Constitution where they've been given the ability to redefine it.
Mm-hmm.
They have the responsibility of trying cases on fact, not by redefining and creating an advantage for themselves. Which is why, when it really comes down to it, folks, if a definition was provided during the ratification debates, then the judges cannot even open up any, you know, they can't open their mouth to utter, well, we see this differently. They're obligated to see it the way it was defined. If they feel that things have changed and it needs to be redefined, who do they go to?
They go to Congress and ask for an amendment.
Well, actually, right? So actually they have to go to Congress. Correct. They have to go to Congress and they have to basically tell Congress to submit an amendment to the states. I just want to make sure that, you know, we're following the full Article 5 process, because sometimes Congress will actually accommodate the court by saying, okay, well, this is, you know, by creating this annotated constitution. Well, that's how we interpret things today.
Yes, yes. Thank you for clarifying that.
Right. Because only the states can provide the clarity as to what their compact means. It is not for the subcontractor to come along and say, hey, we see it this way, and this is the way it's going to happen. I mean, In what world, folks, does your subcontractor come along, like your gardener, come along and say, hey, look, I'm going to store my mower, my Ryder mower, and my manure, and everything else that I use on your property in your living room? Whether you like it or not, that's how it's going down. Because I'm not going to have to cart it off my trailer, you know, when I have, you know, 500, it comes in a 500-pound bag, and I may not need all 500 pounds this year, but I'm going to put it in your property right there in your living room. And when I need it, it'll be there. That's how it's going to go down, buddy.
That certainly wouldn't work well, would it?
Well, that's, you got to understand that the creature, the subcontractor that was created by the compact, doesn't have the authority to change their status. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, this is, I don't understand. I mean, I know I've been doing this for a long time, and I understand that there's a lot of people that, you know, just haven't, you know, been swimming in, you know, the constitutional waters. But this is not rocket science. Most people do understand basic contracts. And they basically, I mean, who would ever hear of a landscaper being able to dictate that way? You know, it's kind of, I used to use that analogy with the general powers, right? When you create a contract with a landscaper and you grant them general powers, hey, you write there in the contract, you say, do whatever you need to make my house the sharpest looking house from the street in the entire town. You've literally given this guy keys to your house to do whatever he feels necessary so that he has all the equipment and material on site. And literally, he could take it to the extreme, and you would have no legal leg to stand on. The framers did not create a contract to allow the federal government to do these extreme things.
Right.
Okay, so now we're back to where we are. Now, it's a no-brainer on the Sixth Amendment that, you know, a defendant has a right to counsel.
Sure.
Assistance of counsel for his defense, which basically has been interpreted and applied that a person, if they're, charged with a crime, that the prosecution, the court, must provide a defense counsel if requested. Now, I think that's good, but as far as I'm concerned, I honestly believe that there needs to be a bar because hold on. There needs to be a threshold as to who is qualified to represent we the people. Why is it that we the people get the dredges of the lawyers coming out of school, the green guys, the guys that don't know how to do anything?
So here's a question.
Yeah.
How does this define? And I wonder about the obviously there were ratification debates on the Bill of Rights. I'm just wondering how they define assistance of counsel or what and who counsel is.
You know, I've never gone through the 13 states debates on the Bill of Rights. All I've had is because, you know, when the amendments were being written, you go to the author of the amendment to ask, well, what does this mean? Now, the question is, during the state debates, did they go back and forth to Congress with a letter here and a letter there and say, what does this mean? Because rightfully so, the party to the compact should actually and has a right to obtain clarity if it is not clear.
Correct.
So that may have happened, but I do know that the debates in Congress really do set the tone because those who authored each of the clauses in each of the amendments actually stood up and said, okay, this is what this means, because we saw that in the 14th Amendment. I mean, you have the you have the document of all the records of the 14th Amendment debates, right?
Right.
Okay, so.
Which is what, because of that, that causes me to bring up this question, you know, how do they define counsel? Because you...
Well, the beautiful thing is, you now have in a Word document the debates in Congress of the Bill of Rights. So, you know, this is where you can go and search that. But my point is this: I'm only going back to the fundamental premise that our legal and justice system was based on the principle that no innocent man could go to jail. That it's better for a guilty man to go free than an innocent man to go to jail, which means that do you give the potential criminals, the potential convicted person who is charged of a crime, and you haven't proven to be innocent, do you give them a subpar attorney?
I see what you're saying.
Do you give them an attorney that's looking for an opportunity to jump over and be a part of the prosecution team? Now they have lawyers have these oaths, of, you know, the bar oath and all of this about seeking justice, but that never removes the ambitions of those who seek opportunity. It happens everywhere. And as far as I'm concerned, I honestly believe that when we're looking at this, you know, this right of counsel, the right to have assistance of counsel, we're going into break. So let me bring this back when we come back around. But I honestly think that you should have a right to actually either cherry pick or seek a qualified attorney who can actually defend you. And so we'll be right back after this promo, folks. But just give this some thought. Under the premise of an innocent man going to jail.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so again, this is really a discussion of the depths of where we really should be regarding our rights and our protections from government. And so, why is it that we actually get, you know, people who are really not suitable to actually protect the public? Now, this is because the paradigm is that almost everybody that is arrested is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the stigma of somebody being arrested for the commission of a crime. Now, actually, you know, we as a society and our mores, right, the moral value, the moral turpitude that we have churned, you know, over time into becoming, you know, not a less than honorable society, then, okay, so, I mean, we're actually allowing crime to be committed today. I mean, come on. If you can get away with $1,000 or less walking out of a store in San Francisco, I mean, this is shutting stores down.
Sure.
Because the government is not even protecting them. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, go after the innocent, you know, in a court, but to basically say it's fair game for the innocent in society. That is the antithesis of what America was, you know, created to do. So,
correct.
So,
and victims.
And I honestly think that when we really started going down this path, you know, I think everybody would love to have F. Lee Bailey defend them. I think everybody would love that. But I don't think it's okay to have some guy that's never even tried a case to actually cut his teeth on you and your case and defending you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there are people that are guilty. You know, if a crime was committed, somebody's guilty of it, right?
Okay.
We just want to make sure that the process and the defense on both sides was duly done. And so the question goes to this. Who should have the benefit in a court of law when it comes to, you know, the prowess of the legal team? Who should have the benefit? Should it be we the people, or should it be those representing government?
Oh, it should always be we the people.
There you go. And because it should be we the people, I honestly think that, you know, we really need to examine, you know, how we afford counsel to the guilty, or suppose I should say the guilty, to those who are accused, to the accused. There we go. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, so. Anyway, so let's move on. the Seventh Amendment. This is where it kind of opens up a new paradigm regarding the foundation of law. So go ahead.
In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Okay, so when it comes down to we're talking about basically common law covers what? Does it cover just crime, or does common law cover civil law as well? Or what people would call not civil law, Roman law, but, you know, like not just a crime, but an injustice.
You know, I think common law would take in, don't you think, just about anything.
Everything. Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. Right. Sure. As a matter of fact, common law had kind of, you know, created many of our courts, such as marriage, you know, divorce court, I should say. And when we look at traffic court, you know, we have these common laws and, the, you know, these are the laws and so forth. And so they create this traffic court, but they forget about this one little thing where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the trial by jury shall be preserved. How is it that states have created traffic court and provided tickets where you don't stand in front of a jury if that ticket value is greater than $20?
I don't know the history of this, GR, but what it actually seems to be is another source of taxation.
Sure it is. Absolutely. And the states and the courts love it because this is how they get rich. So, the more cases that they can prosecute and actually work, I mean, the best traffic, the best speeding ticket, the best ticket period is the ticket uncontested. It becomes a pure recovery of the expense of the officer writing the ticket. And, you know, the cost of the ticket and all of that, and the process of managing and handling that. So, okay, so that costs money. Well, now that they want to add money to that and make money off of it, this is hard, right? This is hard-coded. How many times have we heard, you know, government has to do this one thing because it is the law?
Right.
And folks, it happens every, you know, the progressives will say, well, it's the law. We got to do this. I mean, Biden talking about, you know, the border and having to, you know, follow the law now and changing his position. Well, hold on here. The law states that if you're facing a trial where the controversy exceeds $20, then you have this hardcore right. Mm-hmm. It is a constitutional right of a trial. And so this is why many times when you actually stand in front of the judge and demand a trial by jury, 9 times out of 10, you know, because it doesn't happen that often. But if everybody started doing it, 9 times out of 10, the judge, usually if you push back, the judge will just dismiss it. There are sometimes you'll actually have a judge that, you know, just, you know, I'm not hearing that here. You know, you're guilty. Boom. You're going to pay the fine. Mm-hmm. Then you have to basically attest that. And so, you know, you have to go through appeal and all of that. 9 times out of 10, most people don't want to get a lawyer and go down that path because they just think the system is rigged. And bottom line, folks, it is. It's right. Rigged because it's designed to make money. So anyway, the other part of this is according to the rules of the common law, the very last statement,
yeah.
Right? So tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any other court of the United States. In other words, when this goes to an appeal, if you didn't have the right to actually present the facts, which is what this basically says. You know, you have a right to present your facts, and mm-hmm. you can't present those facts, then you actually didn't even have your trial.
Okay. But so the right to trial by jury shall be no fact. But no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise examined in any court of the United States. So I want to make sure we understand that. No fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States.
Right.
This necessarily double jeopardy. This is something else. I've read this.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure that, you know, I understand it clearly, or even that maybe our audience understands.
Well, so in other words, in the appeal case, the appeal is only to look at whether the rules of common law were followed.
Okay.
But what about your appeal that your case was never heard?
What do you mean?
In other words, you go in and say, look, I want to present my case to a jury. And the judge actually shuts you down and finds you guilty instead of giving you your trial by jury. Okay. There are cases, I've actually seen this, where people have pursued, you know, a trial by jury. And I was actually in court, and this is when I wasn't really astute to the Constitution. We're talking back in the 80s when I was a young kid, committed a crime, and, you know, didn't have this, you know, this, I don't even say a powerhouse of knowledge, but a basic understanding of the Constitution now. And I can see how that person that demanded for a trial by jury, and the judge says, you know, I'm not going to have any of that. You're just stonewalling. You're found guilty, and you'll pay the fine. You know, take it up with the next court. But bottom line, how can he have an appeal if there were no facts heard? He didn't have a chance to present his case.
Okay.
So go ahead.
All right.
Because when you go to the appeal, I'm sorry, I just realized that I need to connect this dot. When you go to the appeals court is actually, their hands are tied that they, you know, so what is your appeal? Your appeal is the overall case that they didn't follow the rules. You never had your trial. So the appeal court should then remand your case back to the lower court and demand that they give you your trial by jury.
Okay. So
that's what should happen.
If you have a jury trial, what do they mean by no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court?
Okay.
What
do they mean by so that? If you actually got your trial and you have a jury trial, then mm-hmm. those facts presented in that case cannot be re-examined. In other words, they can't look at the facts of the case. Their responsibility in the appeal is only to look at whether the rules was inadmissible evidence presented, was evident, was the information suppressed from the defendant to know something that could have actually gotten him off.
Right. Okay.
It's the appeals process really looks for, you know, is there some bad conduct or, you know, maybe, you know, one hand wasn't doing what it was supposed to do in the process. And so they're not there to retry the case. They can't retry the case.
Okay.
Okay.
So then, finally, according to the rules of the common law, how much are we using the common law in the United States today? You know, I don't even think people know what it means.
Oh, well, absolutely not. Because common law, if you look at divorce case and common law, if somebody committed adultery, then, you know, that person would probably lose all rights. I mean, you know, let's just say you have a divorce and let's just say one person in the marriage actually committed adultery. The person that committed adultery would probably stand to lose custody of the children, you know, property rights and everything else because they committed a crime.
Because that's part of the common law.
That's part of the common law, yeah.
So, dumb question. What it doesn't appear that we are using common law prevalently throughout the United States.
Oh, no, not at all. Correct. They have walked away from, and as a matter of fact, there's been an effort. Now, when we went through the ratification debates, there's only one entity that has the authority to basically remove common law.
Okay. State?
More specifically?
More specifically than the
state legislatures.
State legislatures.
Remember, it was the state legislature that common law could not be revoked or basically taken away from the people unless it was done by the state legislature. Excuse me.
And if that were to be done by the state legislature, it would mean that it was by the decision of the people because they're their representatives.
That's right. Not by the courts, who serves a different body of government. Not by the prosecution, which is serving a different body of government, which would be the executive, right? The court is, technically, the prosecuting attorney and the district attorney, those are those who are enforcing the law. That actually falls under the executive.
Okay.
When you look at the single magistrate where the king did it all, but now they divided that. The law couldn't be made by the king. It has to be made by legislators. The law is enforced by the executive. And then the law, the crimes are heard, or the disputes are heard, by the judiciary. So they actually divided all of that up. And if the person has committed the crime, is found guilty, then it goes back into the hands of the executive, where they're, housed in a prison, jail, or what have you, because that's the law of how they're to be kept. So the executive has, two sides of this legal process, the seeking the justice, the prosecution, and then the housing of the criminals if guilty.
All right. So forgive me for not quite letting this go just yet.
That's fine.
The question about, one, wouldn't there be a benefit in using the common law, and why aren't we doing it now?
Well, absolutely, there's a benefit for the people.
Right.
Using common law for good, law-abiding citizens, and moral people, absolutely, there's a huge benefit to common law. But for the godless and those who do not care about sin and or sins being crime, because you got to remember, the godless, you don't have a pin in your pocket anymore because I took it, but I didn't steal it. You weren't using it. And I needed it. For whatever reason, they justified their crimes, but their sins. And, is it a sin if a man goes and, has a tryst with a prostitute? If he's married, is that a crime? How is it a crime if nobody got, hurt? If there's no actual, you tell any person that's, in love and has the person that they love off, and how are you not hurt?
Okay.
Right. So they go through all of these things to lessen and lessen and lessen. Go ahead.
So I found, I believe that the United States has been using common law until sometime in the 30s or 40s. And I found this case called Clearfield Trust Company versus the United States. And I think this is where
the Supreme Court basically ruled that we're not listening to common law cases anymore.
What was up with that? How do they have the authority to do that?
They didn't. It's just like they don't have the authority to redefine anything. They don't have the authority to create law or to change the legal system. But, anything that is in front of them and they choose to do differently, then they will do it until we force them to do their job. And see, what should have happened is that the people should have basically demanded the removal of these judges. Mm-hmm. But by this point in time, you know, people had their hands out from government, right? This was in the 30s. This is during the Depression. People needed government to feed them. And so there's no better time to grow government power than when people need government. Mm-hmm. When people believed they needed government, and actually almost everything that they were suffering from was from government itself. Mm-hmm. Like the Depression, the crash. Okay, so there were a lot of people hurt in that crash. Well, right. As far as I'm concerned, you know, that's what happens when you gamble with your money. Right? You're going to get the fact is the federal government came in and started seizing things, and they started, you know, trying to actually, you know, pay people back, or I would just say give assistance, whether it be via housing, because this is the same point in time. You realize that in the early 30s, right after the crash, that's when the projects in the city started going up. This is all done under Hoover as a helping hand. At the same point in time, you know, they were putting up these projects. Right next to the projects would be a Planned Parenthood.
Yeah. Setup. They referred to those as Hoovervilles.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Right, and so government started doing all sorts of things that they, you know, they didn't have the authority to do. They, you know, they didn't have the right to spend the money on doing those things. And as they intervened, they were where were they getting the money? Mm. They had to take it from somebody.
They did take it.
Right.
Roosevelt,
well, actually,
gold.
Either that or they inflated the currency, so they took it from everybody.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Wow. A lot to fix there.
Yeah. So moving to the Eighth Amendment, we kind of covered this already, but I mean, this really strikes at the core of how our criminal justice system regarding bail and excessive fines and so forth really needs to be reevaluated. I believe that when you're going to be assessed for bail, it should be based on, you know, your financial wherewithal, your affluence. Do you have the financial wherewithal to sustain that type of fine or bail?
Sure.
It's one thing to say, you know, this type of crime should require 50% of whatever that person makes in a year.
Okay.
Then it's equal. Then it doesn't matter if you're a rich person or a poor person. You're losing 50%. You're going to have to pay a fine that would be 50% of what you would make for that year. Now, most people think that rich people have the ability to hide, but I'm just telling you, it just takes a good bean counter to be able to go in and say, you know what, you've been found guilty of this. We're now going to go through and determine, because, you know, sometimes rich people don't pay themselves that much. They kind of suppress that. And so it's just a matter of literally just doing some bean counting to determine, well, that's all yours. Even though you're not receiving it as income, it's still yours. And you can take it at any point in time. Half that's gone. Okay. Now we're going to see rich people realize, oh, you know, I think that maybe we need to change, because they're not being hurt.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. So where are we now?
The Ninth Amendment.
Article 9.
The Ninth Amendment.
The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
Right.
So, you know, when in the ratification debates, when the framers were concerned about expressing rights, they were also concerned that if you express some rights, you would leave some others out.
That is correct.
And I know it was Madison who said, we have a delegated enumerated constitution, and it's simple. What's not there can't be done by Congress. But I think Amendment 9 was what was constructed to address that issue.
Right. In other words, because everybody was claiming that there were general powers, they created a general protection.
Okay. So the Ninth Amendment was what was designed, you know, to answer that concern. And you got it highlighted at full red alert.
That is correct. Because we just had even though government may have a right to exercise their, you know, emergency powers to say if you've got a cold, we recommend you don't, but they can't shut you down. And by shutting you down, they disparaged and they basically denied you the right of commerce, the right of religious worship. In other words, just because they may have had an enumerated power, where the 14th Amendment actually denied them of that. But when we start looking at how government can, you know, all of a sudden start assuming controls and or the ability to control things, whether it be communications, whether it be the internet, things that is clearly not enumerated. These things aren't even enumerated. They're disparaging our rights.
Sure.
Okay. So it's not necessarily it's flaming that way because it's not only, you know, are they misusing enumerated powers like being able to confiscate property without actual just compensation, claiming eminent domain. And so, and this is where the states really need, and folks, this is where you have to, at your county level, when you do your county constitution, you need to determine what is just compensation. That if there's ever a debate that just compensation should go to either a common law jury or a common law grand jury, if it is heavily debated. In other words, it needs to be put into the hands of the people, not to a bureaucrat or a politician to say, we think that, you know, giving you $5,000 for the property because, you know, that's what everybody else's property is worth because we're taking it from you because, you know, Zillow has basically averaged the cost of your house. That's all you're going to get. Well, no. That's not just compensation. You know, it's not like you chose to have to pack up and move. There's all sorts of other costs that you actually have to put on the table to say, hey, look, you're forcing me to move. And this property, the property that I'm going to, there's nowhere in town that has this view. There's nowhere in town that has this. How do you compensate me for these things that have this intrinsic value?
Well, the other thing that you touched upon, GR, and I'm sure the audience will be very interested, is how do we do that? How do we get back to a common law grand jury or using common law to do this type of thing to determine just compensation?
Well, so what the framers did was very, very smart. You have to be specific. And in other words, you have to make sure that, you know, these are the powers enumerated and you limit them. So perfect timing. We just ran out of time, as a matter of fact. So we can come back to this because I honestly, this is something that really needs to go run its own volition to ground. So anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.